Hey everybody, join us as we delve into our favorite dark tales and paranormal mysteries.
Venture with us beyond the safe places that exist in daylight as we go
beyond the shadows. True crime,
paranormal,
hauntings,
UFOs,
cryptids and unsolved mysteries,
conspiracy theories,
past lives,
reincarnation,
and all the like are just a few of the topics that we will tackle.
If it haunts your fucking dreams, then it will be on our show.
Shadows where you find me at. You can't see me in the deepest blacks. When your heart start racing and you see the cracks, all these creepy things that you might attract. All the demons be where the action's at. So listen up if you want it. UFOs, all them ghosts, we got everything that you want. Whoa.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is?
Hey guys, and welcome back to episode 70 of Beyond the Shadows.
Hello and welcome back, Shadow Throng.
Throng? I love thongs.
I use thong every day.
Throng? Yeah. I have no clue what a thong is, but.
Neither did I until about 7 seconds ago. So, I was looking for a alternative definition to army or anything like that. We use it because we use that shit all the time. So, the definition is in the sense of a crowd. A great number of people or things crowded together. So that is you, Shadow Throng.
Shadow Throng. I like thongs better.
Yeah, so thongs can be removed. Not that we want to remove you guys. Yeah,
please stick around. So what do we get in the news this week, bud?
Nut jobs, as usual.
Yes.
So a really classy guy was arrested in Green Bay, Wisconsin the other day for using a deadly weapon. Misdemeanor battery and disorderly conduct.
What was his name?
You tell me.
I'm not sure.
42-year-old D's Nuts.
D's Nuts.
D's Nuts Lee Kroll. So full name. You gotta show him the respect.
Don't miss that last
show,
part.
Show him the respect he deserves. Imagine meeting a girl's dad and his name is D's Nuts.
I thought you were going to say, and your name is D's Nuts.
No, because the story includes his daughter.
Yeah. So
his
dude's name is D's Nuts. Yeah,
D's Nuts. So his daughter and her boyfriend showed up at his house, and they knocked on his door several times. He finally opened the door. He punched his daughter in the shoulder, and then he threatened them both with a BB gun.
So, I mean, D's Nuts sounds like a classy guy.
Oh, sounds very classy.
So, I mean, the name doesn't fit at all.
So his daughter's like, oh, if you want any action, first you got to meet D's Nuts. So according to the police, D's Nuts was highly intoxicated. And according to the arrest report, he was shirtless.
No.
Because if you name D's Nuts, I mean, you want to be, you want everybody to see the skin, right?
you want them to see D's Nuts' chest.
Skin on skin contact.
It seems like he'd have a wife beater on for sure.
No, he wasn't wearing anything. Some sort of sack to hold these nuts in place. You know what I mean? He could have something. He's a classy dude. So
wow.
Congratulations.
Had his name
Green
legally
Bay,
changed
Wisconsin.
To D's Nuts.
I actually didn't write down what it was, but it was in the article. Also in the news. So most police departments are filled with rats and cockroaches. I think we can agree on that.
Yes.
But in New Orleans, that is quite literal. And the rats there are high as shit.
Yes, they are. It seems like these rats like to dip into the evidence room and get a little bit of that sticky icky.
Yeah. they've eaten their way under the door, and they ate the weed. The confiscated weed.
And they continue to eat the weed.
They did.
They said that they can't help but to eat the weed.
They did. That is what they said. So they've actually done research into this, and the experts say that the rats have the same reaction to weed that humans do. So the police have found that the rats now love Hot Pockets, SpongeBob SquarePants, and fish concerts. And that's a fact.
And I saw in the article that they're like shitting on their desk
they are,
and stuff like that.
They're actually shitting on the detective's desk. So I'm proud of those rats.
Right? Is that one rat paranoid in the corner? They're coming for us, man. They're coming. Is that a fucking cat? I know that's a cat.
This guy bagged me back in 98. I'm going to pinch a loaf real quick. You guys hold up.
Little rat bongs. In the.
Those rats know how to party. They do it different down in New Orleans, even the rats.
Yeah, they don't play down there at all.
That's a fun town.
Even the rats are high.
So last news story. A flight in Indonesia recently went on autopilot for an extended period of time while both pilots took a quick nap.
It wasn't really that quick a nap.
No, it wasn't really that. I mean, bad enough they both took a nap.
Yeah, both of them were out cold.
At the same time.
I mean, I can't think of a job where I would want the person.
Yeah, you know, imagine me going into surgery and the surgeon
takes a nap. Takes a nap right here in the room, yeah.
I don't think that's what autopilot was intended for. So the flight took off from it took off and landed in Indonesia. It was Sulawesi region is where it took off from, and it was heading towards Jakarta, which is the capital. When the 32-year-old pilot told the 28-year-old co-pilot to take over for a bit because he needed some rest.
He's just going to knock off for a few.
Yeah, just
a couple minutes. I got
quick
this.
Quick siesta. Yep. It happens. What are you going to do? But after he fell asleep, the co-pilot apparently thought, shit, that looks relaxing.
He looks so comfy over there.
I think I'll grab my Snuggie and take a quick nap too.
So which both of them out cold.
So 241 miles and 30 minutes later, the senior pilot woke up and realized they were way off course.
Somewhere over the ocean.
So he corrected it, but yeah, so it doesn't say what airline that was, but you guys might want to research that.
That's, you know,
I want to avoid that.
That's
airline.
Scary. I mean, it's bad enough when they're drunk, but at least, because that happens all the time, but at least when they're drunk, they're awake.
In the movie Flight with Denzel, he was drunk. But,
yes.
Yeah, but
they're flying upside down.
He brought that shit down, man. He nailed it.
Wasn't he upside down in that movie?
Was.
Yeah. He was flying,
Quote, inverted.
Yeah.
Inverted. You're what? Inverted. Yeah, that was good. That was good. But these guys weren't inverted. They were just sleeping.
Just taking a nap. So, wow. Well, so what are you going to do this week? What do we got?
So I was looking to do something a little bit different this week. We've covered quite a bit of different stuff. So I wanted to do some urgent urban legends, and I wanted to kind of like cover like the where they came from and whether they were based in reality or not. So we're going to call this one Urban Legends Unmasked.
Sweet. Let's do it.
All right. Be right back, guys.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's here.
Getting up there. So our first urban legend comes from here in Maine.
Yes.
For years, rumors had circulated about a strange hermit living in central Maine around the North Pond area. So where I live is about an hour and a half south of North Pond. But I had still heard the legend many times over the years, and I mean a lot. Like, so it made its way down here, so everybody was familiar with this.
This is when I wasn't living in Maine.
Yeah, so this is basically entirely you were not.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything about this till I actually got back.
So locals had told the stories about items going missing from camps around the area for a long period of time. Batteries, food, flashlights, propane, stuff like that.
You know what? Before you go on, I got to explain something because you're being from here. People outside of the Maine, New England area, a camp is a cabin, like on the lake or whatever. When people outside of here hear camp, they think of like a, you know, Friday the 13th camp kind of thing.
It sort of is, though.
Yeah.
So it's a cabin on the lake.
Yeah, but I mean, they're only called camps in this area.
Yeah.
They're called cabins other places. But here, a camp is it's usually on the lake.
It's usually a house, but not your house, not your everyday house.
Yeah, and they're not usually all that fancy. They're usually pretty rough.
They're never fancy.
No.
So the length of this mini crime spree and the unlikelihood that someone could survive out in the Maine wilderness year-round and year after year made many doubt this legend. But this legend was proved correct when Christopher Thomas Knight was captured by Game Warden Sergeant Terry Hughes on April 4th, 2013, while burgling the Pine Tree Camp in Rome, Maine. Knight grew up in Maine, graduating in 1984, and he moved to Waltham, Massachusetts.
Same year as Ryan.
Yeah. A little bit. I was like four. Took a job installing arms. In 1986, Scott's senior year, at the age of 20, Knight abandoned his job and drove up to Maine until his car ran out of gas. That's literally how he set out on his location. He drove north until his car
ran out of gas.
He wandered into the woods, abandoned society, and did not speak to another living soul for 27 years.
Good God, man.
He had no survival skills whatsoever. So he built a camp in a remote part of the woods surrounded by glacial boulders. He survived the coldest part of the winters by waking up in the middle of the night and pacing until he warmed up. He rarely ever built fires out of the fear of them being spotted, but he used propane stoves to melt snow for drinking. He also made sure to stock up on all necessary supplies so that he wouldn't have to leave camp between November and March, so as not to leave footprints in the snow. So he thought this stuff out.
Why would, maybe you're going to get to it, but why was he worried about getting caught? Was he a fugitive?
No, but he was stealing from camps.
Oh, okay.
He was only worried about getting caught from, yeah. So his going into the woods, he was not a criminal. He just wandered into the woods. But at that point, he started burgling camps. So he stabs it.
I get it now.
It's kind of like a weird cycle.
Right. Yeah.
So all told, he committed over 1,000 robberies during his time in the woods, at a clip of 40 a year. When he was caught, he was sentenced to 7 months in jail in order to pay $2,000 in restitution and serve 3 years probation. Now, a lot of the people that he had actually robbed didn't want him sentenced at all. Not all of them. But most people think he wasn't really hurting anybody, and you know, he took small stuff.
When he stole stuff, it was usually – wasn't it like usually canned food?
It was canned, and some people in the area knew that there was somebody out. Again, when it was still just a urban legend, they would leave like canned goods and shit on their porch, and he would not burgle the place. He would just take the canned goods. So they'd basically leave him offerings, and he would take the offerings and leave the place alone. But he never really tore any place up. He'd take a propane canister, a couple cans, a lighter, you know what I mean, small stuff. He didn't tear any place up.
Yeah, for 1,000 burglars.
Yeah, so over 27 years. So I'm not saying anything he did was good, but a lot of people that he ripped off didn't even think he should be in jail. So when they finally caught him, it wasn't like everybody was like, oh my God, they caught this
piece
of shit.
Throw the book at him, yeah.
A lot of people, even when they caught him, like, just leave the fucker alone, which essentially they did. You know, they gave him 7 months in jail. I think he served five of it. He paid $2,000 in restitution, served a couple years probation.
Did he pay that in canned goods? Yeah.
Gave him returnable. So in 27 years, he never slept indoors. And Maine winters are harsh.
Yeah.
Not as harsh as some places, for sure, but they're harsh.
Yeah, they're not warm. That's for sure.
Didn't speak to
it gets below zero, like, here and there.
No campfires. And he never slept indoors.
He never had a campfire.
No. He didn't like campfires because he would have been spotted.
And warm. He would have been warm.
So when I see people like Bear Grylls and shit on TV, I'm thinking, fuck that. Go with this guy. The guy who's actually done it. Yeah, you're doing it for a day on TV. You know, I know Bear Grylls has got some skills. But this guy has actually done it for 27
years. Bear Grylls also stays in hotel rooms.
Yeah, I know he does.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if this guy, if you can minus the robberies,
right,
he's your guy.
Les Strauss, that's the dude. That's the real
Survivor
dude.
Man.
Yeah, right. Survivor Man. Yeah. Les Strauss, he's the real one.
Hello, Beyond the Shadows listeners. I am Rachel.
And I'm Heather.
We are the hosts of Like Mother, Like Murder.
We bring you the good, the badass, and the crime.
Each week, we bring you stories from missing and murdered
to survivors and women who empower you.
And of course, some mom talk sprinkled in.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts at Like Mother, Like Murder.
And give us a follow on social media so that we can say hi.
Okay, love you, bye.
Okay, love you, bye.
So next up, we have the legend of Polybius. A lot of you haven't heard of that, I'm sure.
I have heard of this. I was actually going to do this at some point. So when I saw you were, it's cool.
So the legend of Polybius comes from the height of arcade popularity in America, when Pac-Man and Space Invaders were sweeping the nation and kids spent their every quarter in American arcades. The American government decided to use this latest craze to try an experiment on America's gamers. In 1981, in several arcades around the Portland, Oregon region, a new game was said to have appeared called Polybius. In actuality, the game was a large black box that had no name at all, but players gave it the name Polybius, after a Greek historian. The game was extremely popular and became more or less an addiction. Long lines were said to form for a chance to play the machines, and fights would frequently break out by those anxious to play. Gameplay involved hypnotic patterns and geometric shapes. So it almost sounds like Tetris, but, you know, like a really,
right,
really intense version of Tetris. It was said to be hypnotic and even dangerous. Two teenagers were said to have disappeared shortly after playing it. Those who played were said to suffer from seizures, amnesia, insomnia, night terrors, anxiety, and hallucinations. The machines were said to be visited periodically by men in black, who would then extract the machine's unknown data. There are reports that these machines were in some way related to the government's MK-Ultra mind control experiments of the 60s and 70s, which are well documented. Those are facts.
Oh, absolutely.
Whether or not these are connected isn't known, but the MK-Ultras are definite. So about a month after their arrival in arcades, these machines disappeared from all arcades, never to be seen again.
That's so weird. They're in. I've looked at this, and the people swear to God that these existed.
But only in Portland, Oregon. Nowhere else.
Nowhere else. Nowhere just else. The one place. Yep. Yep.
So there are several people who claim who have seen and played these machines back in 81. A man named Bobby Felstein claims he was abducted after playing the game one day at Coin Kingdom when he was 14. He claims he suffered from mind-altering side effects and was led through an underground tunnel system and was only found the following day, but 60 miles from home. So other than word of mouth, there's no evidence whatsoever that suggests these machines ever existed in reality. There were no pictures, no existing machines, and never showed up in any stories or articles until 1998. So from 1981 till 1998, there is no written record anywhere that these ever existed. That's a 17-year gap.
Right. But people swear they did.
They do. So I don't know where I stand on it. It's widely regarded to be a hoax. And Ripley's, believe it or not, calls it, quote, the most dangerous video game to never exist.
That's cool.
So you give me a 1 to 10 scale, 10 being it definitely existed, 0 it didn't exist. I'm going to put myself somewhere on a 3. I lean towards thinking this is a hoax, but I'm not positive.
I could see him doing it.
No, I can too, but do you remember the video games that existed? I lean towards against it. We had fucking Pong. You remember the beep? You remember those games back then? There's like a little square.
Yep.
So to think, you know, and granted, the government wouldn't release everything they had to us. But to think they had a machine that could extract mental data from one of those things when they couldn't even make
it was just a human more than
a square. it's far-fetched. I don't think they could do it now. I really don't. I think they can do crazy shit. But to think they could extract your data from your brain. I don't think it happened.
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be alien technology. For real. That's the only way that would work. But I don't know. The arcades were huge back then, and the kids spent all their time
in there.
That's
what I remember. When I was little, they were fucking every.
You know, it's funny because your brother used to we had a place called Fun Spot that was an arcade.
It was an arcade in Dover.
And he would be like, whenever you got your report card, the place would give you like so many tokens to play off of your. If you got an A, you'd get like so many tokens, and your brother would be like, come on, let's go to Fun Spot. And I'd be like, nah, fuck that, because I didn't have any A's, man.
I'm with you. I'd go to Fun Spot. My brothers would both get like fucking 40 tokens, and I'd get like a half. You know,
they're fucking playing games all day long. I'm like, give me a token, man. I owed them $47, yeah, brother.
They'd hand me like an empty popsicle stick. Yeah? I'm like, here's it.
Your brother be playing all day long. Just come on, one more token, buddy. I got nothing over here.
Those fuckers.
Stupid smart people.
The place is long gone now.
Oh yeah.
All right, so next up we have the legend of the body under the bed. This is a famous one. This
Oh, yeah.
Pretty much everybody knows this one in some version or not. So this legend goes back decades, and it involves a couple or a family checking into a hotel room and complaining about a foul smell. It's only then that a decaying corpse is found under or in the bed. And this one is horrifyingly true. And it's happened multiple times. In Kansas City, Missouri, a couple checked into the Capri Motel on Thursday, July 13, 2003. They complained to staff about a horrible smell, but nothing was found. After 3 days, they could tolerate the smell no longer, and they checked out that Sunday. After they were gone, the staff finally decided to go ahead and look under the bed, where a corpse was found. So I'm hoping that the housekeeper was fired.
Right?
At that point.
No kidding. Yeah, I don't know. I heard this story, and you may get into it. When I heard this story, the body was like between the mattress and the box spring.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple. There's a couple.
Okay.
So, you know, for a housekeeper, missing like a pube on the toilet is bad. Right. But missing a corpse body under the bed.
That stinks. Yeah, you're not doing your job.
You miss a corpse under the bed. God damn.
You're just spraying a lot of air freshener. What the fuck is wrong in this room?
Excuse me. If anybody wants to check this place out for yourself, you're too late. It was torn down back in 2015. Excuse me. So in an even more horrifying case, Sony Milbrook was reported missing in Memphis, Tennessee on January 27, 2010. She had been staying in room 222 of the Budget Lodge for several weeks with her five children and Lakeith Moody, who was four of her kids' father. Detectives visited the hotel on January 29th, 2 days after she disappeared, to look for her, but they never bothered to enter her room. She had failed to pick up her kids from school, and family members had reported her missing. The hotel bagged up her things. The room was cleared and rented out again. James and Rhonda Sargent next rented it out. They complained to hotel staff that the room, quote, smelled stanky and foul. That's their word, not mine. Stanky. Stanky. They attempted to burn incense to cover up the smell, but nothing worked. Someone had allegedly already tried, as there were dryer sheets stuffed all around the room, so that somebody was trying to cover.
So they knew that it stunk already.
Somebody knew something. The missing persons case got handed off to homicide detectives, who again visited the hotel on February 4th. They questioned motel employees about whether they had seen or heard anything, but again, never bothered going into room 222. So the second time the police have been out and haven't gone to her room.
That's some strong police work right there.
Very strong.
Yep. Good job, cops.
Staff told police there had been nothing unusual, despite the sergeants, who are now staying in the room, having complained daily about the smell in their room that she was last seen in.
They were staying in the room that she was in?
The sergeants had moved into that room, had complained daily to the staff that there was a smell. The hotel staff is telling the police that there was nothing strange about that room. So this whole case is really weird.
Wow.
Really weird. So the sergeants moved to another hotel before coming back to the Budget Inn, as it was more affordable. They bounced between three different rooms, but again stayed in room 222 for one single night. The smell continued, as well as did the complaints, but it wasn't until March 15th, 47 days after she disappeared, that the body of Sony Milbrook was discovered inside the frame of a bed.
God damn, dude. 47 days in the bed, not under it.
She had been in that room the whole fucking time. The room had been cleaned and turned over multiple times during those 7 weeks, and no one had discovered the body. Lakeith Moody was convicted. That's her boyfriend when she disappeared. Was convicted of first-degree murder in connection to her death and was sentenced to life in prison. So if you find yourself in a hotel room with an unpleasant odor, skip the dryer sheets and the incense and look under the fucking bed.
Dude, how lumpy was that fucking mattress?
She wasn't under the – yeah, she was under the bed.
Like, oh, this one was under the bed.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, still, wow. They should have fucking found it. So I think you had the bed, the box spring, and then one of those weird like wooden boxes. I think she was in the box. But still, they should have found it.
You got to investigate, dude. As a cop, you got to investigate. As a hotel worker, you got to find out where the fucking smell is coming from.
Yeah, so when they checked in, there were dryer sheets around the room. So that was clearly put there by hotel staff. So the hotel staff clearly knew there was a stank odor coming from that room. They didn't bother to find it. They just tried to hide it. And the more complaints that came in, the more they just tried to hide it.
More dryer sheets.
In 47 days, that body's got to be gross.
Oh, that's disgusting. Gross. Yeah.
And disrespectful to Sony Millbrook.
Yeah, no kidding. 47 days under a bed.
So there's an urban legend that in one scene of The Wizard of Oz, shortly after Dorothy and the Scarecrow meet the Tin Man, and they skip off singing "We're off to see the Wizard," that a body can be seen hanging from one of the trees in the background. The legend goes that during filming, one of the residents of Munchkin Land was suffering from depression. Most likely due to lost love. And as a result, he went up to the roof of the studio and he hung himself. And his swinging body was accidentally captured in the background.
So this is one I've seen. And it to me, it definitely looks like there's a munchkin hanging in the background. Yeah,
it doesn't look like it's nothing. So when you hear this legend and you look at it, it looks legit.
I've heard several different things about it. Like I heard it was a sandbag. I've heard a bunch of stuff. But yep. I'm interested to see what you got to say.
Hi, I'm Natasha with Cryptids, Creeps, and Conspiracy. Embark with me on a journey to uncover the details involving cryptids, haunted houses, and unsolved mysteries. Get ready to awaken your curiosity and explore the unknown. Ask questions, and together, let's unravel the secrets behind the legends.
So the legend itself actually took off after the 1989 hype for the 50th anniversary of the film in its digital release. In reality, though, the Munchkins did not arrive on set until after the scene in which Dorothy and the Scarecrow meet the Tin Man had already been filmed. So this is the scene.
So they're not even there.
The scene in which the Munchkin was hanging in the background.
They weren't even there
They weren't on set for even that scene yet. So it makes it extremely
unlikely. So it'd be real hard for the fact that
they weren't there. And that came from one of the Munchkins himself. The last living Munchkin, I didn't write down the date or his name, but he did an interview and he himself said that it was definitely not a Munchkin. We were not on set when that was filmed.
Hmm.
There's also a lot of rumors that the Munchkins were like really unruly. They were drunk on the whole set.
They were rowdy Munchkins.
He's like, that's not. So, I mean, who knows? I wasn't there. Maybe he's covering it all up.
We were drunks, and we don't want everybody to know. Yeah, I can see that.
So that's my ex-girlfriend. I had to get rid of her.
Yeah.
So the film itself definitely predates the stricter safety regulations. And, you know, 1939, it was different for
sure. No OSHA back then.
Hollywood now employees, and there was definitely a big rash of injuries and a lot of unfortunate incidents. So The Wizard of Oz has gained a reputation as one of those cursed films, and you can kind of see why.
Well, that house fell on that witch.
It did.
That couldn't have been an accident.
It didn't work out so well for her, but her sister. Her sister did all right. To give the forest scenes an extra sense of reality, the filmmakers borrowed a bunch of birds from the Los Angeles Zoo. And it's one of these birds that's in the background that gets mistaken for the hanging corpse that's most likely an emu or a crane.
Okay, so that sounds crazy to me. So we actually paused here.
Yeah.
And I went back and looked at the picture because I pulled the picture for the social medias and it looks like someone's hanging in the back. Now I go and look at it. I can definitely see the bird thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see where it looks like there could be like an ostrich or something back there. But
I'm a huge fan. Just so everybody knows, I'm a huge fan of The Wizard of Oz. I always have been. My mother read it to me when I was a little, like little
girl.
And then I was finally able to, yeah, no. When I was gaining, when I first got my boobies.
Up to when he first had his period. But he loved them.
I remember her reading it to me when I was little, and that was one of the first movies I saw, and I was always a big fan of it growing up. I've read the book as an adult. I love it. So yeah, the whole thing, I was always...
It's a big childhood thing for you.
Big childhood thing for me. In the hanging body in the background, I just never saw it. And I've seen the movie a billion times. It's just not there.
So I've watched film on it, and I've seen something back there through the film and stuff like that. But now when I'm going back looking at it, I can definitely see what they're talking about. With the still pictures, though. I'm not looking at the video.
No, there's something there. But it isn't a hanging munchkin, is what I'm trying to say. You know what I mean? If you're looking for something, you'll find it. And you can twist it into whatever you want it to be.
But let's not ruin Ryan's favorite movie.
So the legend... Fuck, I lost where I am. So the movie's gained a reputation over the years as a cursed movie, and the internet has allowed the legend to grow. So the legend holds that in 1988, the hanging figure was edited out. But the hanging figure is also missing from the pre-1988 prints as well. And there is no evidence whatsoever that there was ever a hanging or a death on set of The Wizard of Oz.
That seems kind of... I swear I've seen a video on YouTube, and maybe it's something that somebody altered. It looks like something swinging back in the background. I've seen it before. But.
So they think that at some point some clown edited it in and then edited the edit, you know what I mean? And then they made it...
Photoshop shit.
Nobody would ever know. So I don't know. I do not believe. Since I'm the one doing the episode, I'm allowed an opinion, and I do not think there was ever. And I'm pro conspiracy theory. I think most everything is a conspiracy theory. I don't think there was.
No, I'm with you. I don't think that there was.
I don't think it happened.
No, I don't either.
So next, we're gonna do the tainted Halloween candy, which everybody believes.
Oh yeah.
Since we've been kids, we've always thought about this.
Well, I mean, there's got to be a reason why they're X-raying Halloween candy, because they do.
And there is.
Yeah.
So all kids are taught to thoroughly check their Halloween treats as their neighborhood is potentially loaded with monsters looking to poison their goodies. But in reality, is this a real thing or an urban legend concocted by their overprotective parents? The origin of this legend dates back to New York in 1964, when one lady was visited by kids that she deemed too old to be trick-or-treating. She handed out dog biscuits, steel wool, and ant baits. The labels were still clearly attached with a poison disclaimer, so her intent was to make some sort of point rather than to actually cause harm. But she was arrested and convicted for her actions. In 1970, a 5-year-old boy in Detroit died after finding and ingesting his uncle's heroin. The family decided to sprinkle some heroin on the boy's Halloween candy to make it seem as though a stranger had killed him and to fool the authorities, but it didn't work. In 1974, a boy in Deer Park, Texas, died after consuming a pixie stick that was filled with cyanide. However, it turns out that the tainted Halloween candy hadn't come from a stranger, but from his own father. His father had also given tainted candy to his daughter and 3 other kids in an attempt to make it seem random.
So what you're saying is the Halloween candy you have to look out for is the Halloween candy in your own goddamn house.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. None of the other kids ate the tainted candy. The father's motive for killing his son was to collect insurance, and he was executed in 1984.
Good.
In the early 80s in Japan, a crime ring threatened candy manufacturers that their product was in danger if a ransom was not paid. Eventually, some poison cookies and candies were indeed found on store shelves, and they had to be pulled and destroyed. Japan does not celebrate Halloween, however, and the event had nothing whatsoever to do with the holiday. But the press that the incident received and the connections stuck. So people just remember that candy right. and the cookies being destroyed. It had nothing to do with Halloween. It didn't have anything to do with those people. But it stuck. Several other incidents occurred over the years where children died while eating Halloween candy. And poison was naturally assumed to be the culprit. But in none of these incidents was that the case. They had died of unrelated health issues. And they happened to be eating Halloween candy at the time. In 1988... The New York Times reported that a New Jersey state lab had found strychnine on a candy shop's jelly dinosaurs. The candy shop had been raided, and the jellies had been confiscated. Eventually, the suspect dusting on the jellies was determined to have been cornstarch, but by then the story had run, and the damage to the business had been done. The business had destroyed 10,000 boxes of their candy, and the Times had run a retraction, but it was much too late to stop the rumor mill. So all in all, there are zero documented instances of a stranger having poisoned a child's candy.
That actually surprises zero. The shit out of me.
Zero.
That's there's, a very
been,
shocking
There's been
me.
Multiple incidents, but they were never by a stranger, not once.
Wow. Because I remember as a kid, the big one was either razor blades or barbed wire.
I said poison. We haven't gotten to that yet. There is. Okay. Yeah, so we have covered there are no incidents of a stranger ever poisoning
Halloween candy.
Somebody poisoning a stranger's Halloween candy.
Okay.
We haven't covered the razor blades yet. We're about to get there, though. So there have been a few instances of sharp objects having been inserted into a child's treat. Many of these were determined to have been done by the children themselves for attention. And they were obviously not hurt, because if a child knows it's in there, they're not going to eat it.
Right.
However, in 2000, a man in Minneapolis, I didn't say that right, but Minneapolis, was arrested for inserting needles into Snickers bars and then handing them out. One child was pricked with a needle, and the man was charged with one count of adulterating a substance with intent to cause death, harm, or illness. So he didn't kill anybody. One kid had to get like a Band-Aid, basically.
Yeah.
But his intent
was to harm. Yeah.
Malicious, but that wasn't until 2000.
Yeah, I mean, when you said that, I'm like, because I heard this stuff as a kid, man.
That's it. The first instance that you can really get to is 2000. So while it seems that this myth has been way overblown, which I think it has, as no child has ever died by ingesting a tainted Halloween treat, it's hardly a harmful legend, as it does keep both parents and children vigilant.
But, you know, if it's truly that, they really do x-ray kids' candies at the hospitals. They'll allow the kids to come in and do an x-ray.
It doesn't hurt.
No, it doesn't. But, I mean, it's really – x-rays aren't cheap. Apparently they are to do candy,
but as we covered in the story, it doesn't happen much, and when it does, it's somebody you know.
As a kid, it was all what I always heard was razor blade. No one eats the fucking apples anyways. No. I mean, what kid's gonna get an apple? But it was always barbed wire or
the
razor blades and an apple.
The home baked goods are the ones you avoid. The home baked goods,
and you were always pissed when you got those anyways.
No, but they're the sweet old ladies. They can't afford other stuff, but they handle the cookies, and they do, and they're harmless. But kids didn't touch them. I never did. They got chucked immediately.
Yep.
It was like the the Snickers bars.
It's because they weren't wrapped. You know, if they weren't wrapped or sealed, they were going in the trash.
The popcorn balls. They were going in the trash immediately.
Right away. Yeah. You're throwing them at somebody.
Yeah, my parents were never going to have that. But the story shows that, it doesn't show anything, but historically speaking, this legend is overblown. They strangers are not poisoning the kids' candy.
This might be one of the biggest ones I remember as a kid. This was always talked about.
Everybody knows this. There is not a single documented case that a stranger has ever poisoned another stranger's candy. It's always been a known person.
Family member.
Person. Yeah, somebody that's been known.
So I've been watching you, Mom. Look out. It's where it's coming from. It's coming from their own families.
Anybody who's listening now is going to be like, oh, fuck, now I can get away with it.
You're right.
They're not looking at us anymore.
I'm on to them.
All right, so next we're going to do the choking Doberman. And I remember hearing this when I was a kid, too. So this one,
I don't. This I'm not one, familiar with this.
This one goes back a ways. So the legend of the choking Doberman seemingly originated in the United States and dates back at least 40 years. Like most urban legends, there are several variations on some of the details, but the general story goes like this. A woman goes out for the evening with some friends and returns home where she lives alone to find her pet Doberman choking in the hallway. She rushes the dog to the vet, where the vet tells her that he will have to perform a surgery later in the evening, and she will have to leave the dog with him. He will call her later when he has some news. Later on, after the woman has arrived home, the phone rings, and when she picks it up, the vet frantically tells her to get out of the house immediately. What he found in the dog's throat were three severed fingers. When the police arrive at the house, they find the intruder still hiding in a bedroom closet, sans the three fingers.
I didn't know this one.
Now, it's a great story, but did it happen? So the origins of the story date back to 1981. The Phoenix New Times reported the story more or less as described exactly above, and it was supposed to have happened in Las Vegas. They were told the story from a guy who heard it third hand from another guy, who heard it from a woman whose relatives in Las Vegas knew the dog's owners. Now, if that sounds convoluted as shit, it should. The Las Vegas Sun also heard the tale, and they were anxious to break the details, but neither they nor the police could ever track down the dog, the owner, or a single shred of evidence that this incident ever occurred.
Yeah, this one's foreign to me. I didn't know this one.
A brother of a brother. Everybody that's heard it has heard it from a ninth, you know what I mean?
Ninth, yeah.
In the ensuing decades, the story has also been reported to have happened in Australia. It's really taken a hold in Australia way after the fact. But nonetheless, these things travel.
Uh-huh.
The dog has also shifted to a pit bull. It's no longer a Doberman. And the number of fingers varies. It goes from one to five, all five.
And we're spreading it across the world, so there you go.
America, USA.
Yeah.
In most versions, the intruder is caught inside a closet, but in one variation, he escapes, but he's tracked down by police when he shows up in the ER to be treated for all his missing fingers. For me, the most telling detail on this one, even before I read that it was a fake, is that the vet tells the woman to leave, because he's going to perform a surgery later that night. But if the dog is fucking choking, you don't be like, you know what? Go home. I'm going to take a quick nap, have some dinner, and then I'll look in his throat. If the dog's choking, he's choking.
The part I found is that he's still in the closet.
Yeah.
You know, the people go to the vet and they come back and he's still hiding in the closet.
They said it was, quote, blood loss. But I doubt the blood loss from two fingers or whatever it is so much that you're going to pass out cold for hours. I don't buy that. But also... You know, if the dog's choking, and all versions of the story, the dog's choking to death. Relax, go home.
He'll be fine.
I'm gonna have dinner. When I get a chance, I'll look in his throat, and it's only then that I'm like, "Oh my god, get out of the house!" So I'm gonna put this one in this is definitely legend.
This one's legend for sure.
All right, so the next one we have is called the Babysitter and the Man Upstairs. You guys probably won't know it by this name, but once I get into it, you'll definitely know. This story's been around for quite a while.
They made movies from this one, haven't they?
They have several. So this next urban legend goes back quite a ways and has inspired multiple movies, including Black Christmas and When a Stranger Calls. The story, in its simplest version, holds that a teenage girl was babysitting two children while their parents went out for the night. The children were asleep upstairs, and the babysitter was watching TV downstairs. The phone rings, and it's a landline, so you know this one goes back a bit. It's not generally a part of today's stories. And the stranger tells the girl to, quote, check on the children. The girl dismisses the caller as a weirdo. She ignores his instructions, and she goes back to watching TV. He phones back several more times, again instructing her to go upstairs and check on the children. Finally, she gets scared, and rather than checking on the children, she phones the police. They agree to put a trace on the line in case the man phones back. Before long, he does. And after the call is complete, the police phone back and tell her to flee at once as the call is coming from inside the house. She rushes from the house and in the arms of the police, who are already on scene. They enter the house and find the intruder upstairs, and the children are dead. He had gained entry through a second floor window, and the babysitter was intended to be his next target. There are many variations to this legend. In some, one child dies, and the other one lives. In some, it's three children. In some variations, the children survive, and in one version, it's the children themselves who actually make the call. There was never an intruder, and they were just fucking with her.
Huh.
There's a similar variation from California called the clown statue. This one's creepy, but it's close. And it reads like this. A girl is babysitting for a wealthy couple in their large house when they go out for the night. The children are in bed upstairs, and the couple ask the girl to watch TV in their bedroom upstairs so she can be nearby the children. It seems that the children have been having nightmares about clowns lately. She puts them to bed and begins watching TV in their bedroom, but she's unnerved by the very realistic and creepy-looking clown statue in the corner. She tries to ignore it at first, but she gets the unmistakable feeling that is not only watching her, but it has moved slightly. She goes downstairs and calls the phone number that the parents had left her. When the father answers, she asks if it's okay that she watches TV downstairs instead. Of course, he says, but how come? Because I'm freaked out by your clown statue, she replies. Get the kids and get out of the house. We don't have a clown statue, he replies. Now, in this version, the children generally survive, but these two tales definitely seem to have sprung from the same legend. So did it ever happen, is the question. In any semblance of the stories I just told, no. So the story does seem to stem from a real event. All the way back in 1950, 13-year-old Janet Crisman took a babysitting job in Columbia, Missouri. So during the evening, police received a phone call from Crisman screaming for help, but she was unable to give the address where she was at before the phone call was cut short. When the couple arrived back home, the porch light was on and the front door was unlocked. A side window had been forcibly opened. They found her lifeless body lying in a pool of blood on the carpet. She had also been sexually assaulted. The children were unharmed, but the case was never solved. Police had a prime suspect in Robert Mueller, who was familiar with both the babysitter and the couple she was babysitting for, the Romacs. He had made inappropriate comments about Crisman's figure on several occasions, and he had actually been with the Romacs that night playing cards, but he had left early claiming he had to check on a sick child at home. But it was later determined that he had never gone home that night. But he was, however, aware of Crisman's whereabouts that night, as he had checked on her availability to babysit for him that night previously. He also phoned the Romacs the next morning to inquire if they needed help cleaning up after the murder. But at this point, the murder had not even been made public yet. But he was never charged, though, and the case remains unsolved. So that's it for this batch of Urban Legends Unmasked.
Yeah, I like those, man. Those are really good. So many of those are from my childhood that I remember, especially.
There's a lot. And you guys probably know a bunch that I didn't get to, and it's not because I didn't think of them. I covered a ton. So in my mind, I guess. So the ones you probably thinking of I haven't got to, we'll get to on the next batch.
Yeah, the one that you just told, those are really like some of the major ones from my childhood. Expect the Halloween candy for sure. I think that's everybody's.
Every kid's been haunted by that.
Yeah, and that one really surprised me to find out that there really has been no cases.
So, allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. You still check
you
your
know
shit.
There was.
Check your shit.
Yeah, for sure. So, all right, man. Great job with that. I really like that.
Thanks, bud.
So,
we're going to head over to the fire pit.
All right. See you over there. All right, guys. So if you have any of your own fire pit stories, please send them in. They can be paranormal. They can be something crazy that happened in your life. It doesn't matter. Anything that you would talk about sitting around the fire pit,
You can send them in to beyondtheshadows207@gmail.com. You can send them to the Instagram. You can send them to the Facebook, the X, the everything.
Just get them in here.
Yeah, just get us those stories.
But you're right, Charlie. We love the British ladies.
So here it comes. This one is coming to us from Charlie from Bristol.
Hi, Shadow People. I heard you like British girls, so hello. My name's Charlie. I live in Bristol in the UK. I've been listening. I can't remember why I started listening to you. You must have come up on an advertisement on another podcast I listened to. And you guys have me laughing so much. So thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing. Really enjoying it. Keep up the good work. I've been wanting to send something in for ages and I just couldn't really think what would work. And then as a bit of a true crime buff myself, I thought, well, maybe I would look at some of the spooky goings on in the city I live in. So Bristol is an incredibly historic harbour city. Our fortunes were made off the backs of slavery, unfortunately, and the trading of spices and tea and all that sort of thing. So we have our fair share of people, including, so they say, the Blackbeard used to live here. I can tell that story if people are interested about the Blackbeard and what he used to get up to. But my story today, I'm going to try and condense it as much as possible, otherwise I'll be here forever. And I think you guys should definitely cover her on a proper full-length episode. But it's Amelia Dyer, who basically killed babies for a living. She ran something called a baby farm. So back in the Victorian era, if you were a mother and you couldn't take care of your baby for many of the socio-economic reasons that there were, out of wedlock, couldn't afford it, you would pay someone who owned a baby farm to look after your baby and either adopt it out or kind of hold on to it, a bit like a pawn shop, a baby pawn shop. Maybe not the best words to use, but then you could get your baby back. What Amelia Dyer realised is that if she just took on the babies, took the money and then murdered them, she could take on a lot more babies and earn a lot more money. She abandoned them, poisoned, suffocated, battered and starved them to death. Women would come back for their children and she would claim that they died or they'd been adopted and there'd been a mistake. And eventually it happened so often that there started to be a bit of heat towards her. She was arrested a few times for what she was doing. Part of her punishment on one of her jail sentences was going to the local mill, which was also a prison, and physically pushing the millstone to grind the wheat to make flour. That mill still exists today, Shepton Mill. I do buy their flour, so there you go. Eventually, it got too hot in Bristol, so she moved out to London, continued with her dastardly activities, and eventually, with some good old-fashioned police work and somebody hooking a sadly deceased baby wrapped in newspaper and part of an envelope from where she previously lived, they managed to catch her. And she was hanged. So, yeah, that's the story of Amelia Dyer. I've got plenty more where that came from. So if you want more, let me know. Thanks, guys.
Awesome story, Charlie.
Yeah, there's some dark history. Yeah, boy. Some dark shit right there.
For sure.
We appreciate you sending the story
we
in.
We cover plenty of dark shit as it is.
Oh, absolutely. If anybody has any stories that they want to send in, like we said, it can be like what Charlie did here, story from your town. It can be a story from your past. It can be whatever. Just get a story into the fire.
It can be from your town's dark past, like Charlie just told you.
Absolutely.
Anything you got, personal story. It can even be a funny. We've covered that.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, man, the ladies over in Britain, man, they like to share, and we love it when they do. And so we have some stuff coming from an Australian listener here soon, but it's not recorded, so we're not going to get to hear the accent.
Damn it. I'll read the accent.
Yeah.
But it ain't the same when
he's
going to
read it.
It ain't the same when I read it.
It's not going to be as hot when Ryan reads the accent.
I'm going to sound like Crocodile Dundee. It ain't the same.
No, that's a knife.
I'll give it a shot, though.
Anyways. But no, send your story in. Thank you, Charlie. We appreciate you sending that in to us.
That was awesome. Send us some more. We love your accent. We love your voice. You're right. You're right. I'm a sucker for it.
Yeah, for sure. All right, guys. Well, we will catch you in the next one. Thank you.
Later, guys.